I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Stanley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:14, Wednesday, April 14th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And if you stick around, John and I have a big announcement about next week's show.
Hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And it has to be mentioned, I know you know where I'm going with this, the Boston Red Sox, 7 straight wins. Mookie who?
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And ironically enough, aside from it being April 14th, 2021, it is also the 24th birthday of my oldest daughter, Carly, who was born right around this time, 24 years ago. And believe it or not, Joe Ursino, trainer Joe Ursino, actually has a hand in that whole story that we'll talk about later.
That's what you call a teaser in the biz. I thought I had the teaser perfected, but John got an even better one in there. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The Keeneland Spring Meet is back. Take in the excitement and celebrate Keeneland your way, whether at the track or at home. In celebration of the finest traditions of thoroughbred racing in the heart of horse country, Keeneland invites you to watch live on the Keeneland Race Day app, Facebook Live, or Keeneland.com. For more information, go to Keeneland.com/racing. All right, so we had our last round of Derby preps. We should be all set right now. Everybody's got their points. No more points races. We should have a pretty good handle on the field. We've had a couple of defections in the past week or so, but the big race over the weekend was the Arkansas Derby. This was kind of a anticlimactic, I would say. You know, we were expecting this big showdown between Concert Tour and Cattle River, and we did get that. But both of them softened each other up for Superstock to win over the top. We're going to talk to Steve Asmussen a little bit later. It's an interesting horse for him and his family. It's co-owned by Steve Asmussen's father. He was raised at their Laredo training facility. So we'll ask him about that. Only got a 92 buyer. So not, you know, I am like becoming less enamored with the three-year-olds the longer this season goes on. I thought, you know, earlier in the year, this was a really, really strong crop, and I still think it's decent, but I don't know. I haven't seen as many breakout performances as I thought I was in this last round of preps. You know, Superstock got a perfect trip, just sat in behind dueling leaders and then just tipped out in the lane and swept by them late. Great ride by Ricardo Santana, who's, I think, one of the most underrated riders in the country. I was a little bit impressed with Cattle River fighting back for second. I thought that was a good effort. And it just goes to show you, you don't take the horse's best weapon away from it. You know, they strangled the horse back in the Rebel. And what happened? He came up sputtering and finished a well-beaten fifth. This time, you know, you could argue he was a little bit of a disappointment because he lost to a horse that was slower to him on paper, but he battled back for second, and second pays a hell of a lot better than fifth. See what happens when you actually put the horse on the engine. I wish more jockeys would do that on a regular basis. But regardless, it's a much different looking race afterward than before. Concert Tour, I think, was going to be one of the presumptive favorites in the Derby after maybe Essential Quality. I don't know that another horse was going to take more money than him going into this race. And now, you know, he had the better trip than Concert Tour. He got to sit and just stalk that horse and get first run. And for him to even blow second, I thought was a pretty poor performance. And Baffert was, I thought, surprisingly noncommittal after the race about running him in the Derby. I figured, you know, he's got the points. He's run well enough. He was undefeated before this race, so I figured he would definitely go. He probably still will go, but Baffert's being a little coy about whether or not he's going to send him off of this effort. Don't know what to make about Cattle River in the Derby. I think, you know, he's going to have to find a relatively easy pace to factor, and I don't know that that's going to happen. But let's hear from you guys about the Arkansas Derby.
Yeah, the story, I think, was Baffert, Joe. You know, I was riding, and a lot of other people were, a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, that how's this guy going to lose the Kentucky Derby? You know, look at the lineup of horses he had, led by Life is Good. Life is Good goes down. Then it looks like, okay, Concert Tour is going to be his big horse. Concert Tour is sure he can win the Derby, but it's hard to really like him coming in off a performance like this. So lo and behold, Bob Baffert's going to be just another trainer at the Kentucky Derby. He's not going to have the favorite. He's not going to have anyone that will probably be in the top two or three in the odds. But the whole Derby picture, you know, Essential Quality has just not made any mistakes this year. And by that process, he's shot up to number one because everybody else is getting knocked off. You know, Greatest Honor was out, Life is Good is out. Then a concert tour doesn't run well. So, I mean, he's a pretty solid favorite now for the Kentucky Derby. But, you know, maybe Joe would want to answer, maybe John would want to answer this. Who's the second choice? I have no idea.
Yeah, you can kind of throw a bunch of horses into a bag and shake them up and see which one pops out for, you know, the bottom part of the exact or trifecta bets that we're all going to place for the Kentucky Derby. I mean, the preps for the Arkansas Derby, obviously, and the Lexington, you know, ran this weekend. But to me, the most impressive, horse of the weekend was actually Stage Raider, who broke his maiden, the half brother to the Lieutenant and Champion Justify. And, you know, he ran just a massive 7 furlongs at Keeneland and ran a 95 buyer. And again, that's not the be all and end all, demographic you're looking for, but it's a pretty impressive number when the 95 eclipses pretty much the majority of the 3-year-olds that are going to be running in the Kentucky Derby in 2 weeks. So the fact that we're even talking about a maiden race over, you know, the last two preps for the Kentucky Derby, I think shows you that the horses have come back to the group a little bit, come back to the pack a little bit. And other than Essential Quality, there's a bunch of horses that you can look at, hopefully ours included, that can make a case for themselves and wouldn't be surprising if they hit the board in the Kentucky Derby. But I agree, Joe, with what you're saying before. I was very enamored with the group, in February into March, and some of the luster is off the majority of the group, going into the race in 2 weeks.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, Stage Raider was monstrous in that race. And I want to give a shout out to you. You're way too humble to do it, John. You know, it's just so typically humble of you to not mention Cronus's big run in that race. John and our co-worker slash co-host, Brian DiDonato, own Cronus, who was third in there and really ran a good race. I thought was really the only horse other than the winner that was really finishing in that race, and he just probably needs a little bit more ground, but he's definitely got some talent. So yeah, Stage Raider was huge in that race. And also Baffert had a 3-year-old named Following C on Saturday, who was made a TDN Rising Star by Run Happy. Talking about a sire that's really coming on, you know, Run Happy, you gotta call a spade a spade. He looked like a bust in his first year. You know, he couldn't get any runners on the track, and now he's got a bunch of them. And now he's really coming on. So, you know, I guess all that promotion was going to be a good thing in the end, because, you know, he's like I said, he's really coming on and looks like a really good second crop sire this year. So those two, you know, it's, yeah, like, you know, like we were saying about the 3-year-old crop and how some of the bloom is off the roses, I like to say, from these top 3-year-olds, maybe a maiden winner like Following Sea or Stage Raider can jump right in to the Preakness and really factor against some of these 3-year-olds, especially off of just 2 weeks rest. So I think that's definitely something to watch. I think there's going to be an abundance of new shooters in the Preakness and the Belmont this year, unless someone runs off and wins the Derby by 10 lengths. But that seems pretty unlikely at this point. Even Essential Quality, as a legitimate favorite, he's not the kind of horse who's going to do that. He's just going to, you know, win by a pole. But yeah, he's the clear favorite. I think it's been a little bit of a war of attrition here. All the other top contenders have kind of fallen by the wayside, and he's stuck it out, and he's 5 for 5. So definitely looks like a legitimate favorite. I wanted to throw up the contest standings too, before, because we haven't really run them down in a while. And this is the final chapter before we head to the Derby. We're still, I don't know if I should offer this peek behind the curtain, that we're still trying to decide how many points the Derby should be worth. last year we had it be 300, but that was a longer run up. So there were a lot more points beforehand. Whereas now, as you can see on the screen, Brian has the lead with 195. I think he's done well, despite losing Greatest Honor and now Roman Centurion, Concert Tour, and Stash and Rombauer have all gotten points for him. Bill is in second with Essential Quality and Medina Spirit. Those are the only two he's got left, but he's got the favorite, so he's a challenger as well. John's got 152. He's probably maxed out unless he gets a big performance from Midnight Bourbon or Highly Motivated. Al's got 100 from Hot Rod Charlie, probably one of the fringe contenders. He's got Mandaloon, who I like potentially as an upsetter. And I finally got a few points this week, thanks to Caddo Rivers, second in the Arkansas Derby, but not feeling too great about just having him and maybe a long shot outsider in Dream Shake. But it is close, and it's going to be interesting once we figure out how many points the Derby is worth to see who ends up on top. But my money is on Brian or Bill right now.
You know, what's really fun is that it's a really close race. Despite the fact that you know, we all pick kind of some long shots in there as well. Any of us can actually win depending on the final point total for the Kentucky Derby. What I'm most surprised about is you know, how well Bill was doing when at the end of the draft, he was like, Joe, you're going to win. You know, my team sucks. I mean, you put together a nice little group there, Bill Finley.
It's like the Red Sox jinx. First Red Sox jinx. Thanks, guys. You were all talking about my stable, and that ended pretty quickly. Just wanted to mention a few other races before we move on from the weekend. Raging Bull got his third grade one, first win in a while in the Maker's Mark Mile. Got a great trip under Rad Ortiz. Juliet Foxtrot and the Jenny Wiley, I thought she really deserved a grade one win. She'd been knocking on the door in grade one races. I think she had placed in four grade ones before that. And she appeared to be loose on the lead in that race and was over a very boggy turf course. So I think she was deserving of that race. Toby's Heart, it was good to see her come back and win the Limestone Turf Sprint. I think that's clearly what she wants to do. I still would like to see her try dirt at some point in the future, but it's good to see her back in the winner's circle. What else? I mean, that's pretty much it. It was a pretty slow weekend of racing outside of Arkansas and a couple of races at Keeneland, but definitely to me, the takeaways beyond the Arkansas Derby are the impressive maiden winners and the way they may factor in the Triple Crown going forward. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So this got a lot of play on the TDN website and on Twitter. If you want to go have a laugh, go check out the replies to our post of this story on our Twitter account. Peter Miller, who is currently third in wins and fourth in earnings at Santa Anita, has been fined a whopping $500 for a class 4 finding of isoflupridone, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, that was confirmed via split sample testing when his trainee Hembry won the grade 2 Joe Hernandez Stakes January 1st at Santa Anita. It's according to TD's story, it's an injectable steroid primarily administered for anti-inflammatory effects. It's got a 4C categorization, which is on the less severe side of the scale of the Uniform Classification Guidelines for Foreign Substances list posted by RC. I feel like we're kind of repeating ourselves at this point with these stories, but obviously this is a terrible look and it's a terrible process to have a guy win a grade 2 race with a horse that was on an illegal substance. And then the fine is $500, which if you bet the race, he probably made more than that betting the race, forget the earnings from the purse that he got. And, you know, he's another guy that has had positives in the bag in the past. And, you know, I think he rubs people the wrong way. And I think that's why people were pretty outraged about this, because this stuff happens all the time. It insert the trainer's name who has had some shady doings in the past. And, you know, they just get a slap on the wrist. $500 is obviously nothing. The problem is the CHRB was restricted in what they could fine him based on him not having a previous disqualification for drugs in the past year or whatever. So I guess they were hamstrung and this is all they could do. But this is why we need Heisa and USADA and Travis Tiger. Like, there is no fear right now for, you know, to break from breaking the rules. Like, you just, you know, that it's just a cost of doing business. Fine. And it's like even less than the cost of doing business. It's like the cost of doing the most minimal amount of business. It's like when you see a big company like on Wall Street or in, you know, wherever, they do something shady and then they get a slap on the wrist from the government and they just basically chalk it up as an expense. This is like the least expense I think that a trader has over the course of a year. It's like, yeah, I'll get fine $500 for a drug positive. That's, you know, that's the worst that you can do for that to them, or $1,000 is the worst that you can do to them. Signals a broken system more than just this individual incident. It's a broken system. It's a fragmented system and it needs to be replaced entirely. And it's weird how it was so quiet, all quiet on the Western front from all the HBPAs when stuff like this happens. You know, they love to talk about, you know, the constitutionality of getting rid of this garbage, broken system that we have. Well, how about this? What would be your response to stuff like this? Do you think that this is the way to go? You think this is the right system? Because I think everybody in the world would disagree with you if you say yes. This is clearly a screwed up situation where you cannot ever punish trainers for, you know, egregious overages, and they're just going to keep doing it because they have no fear. Pass it over to Bill now.
Yeah, I'm going to take a little bit of a contrarian view from what you just said, Joe, that I never get that hot and bothered about these positives where, you know, I don't think anybody who really knows what's going on thinks Peter Miller had this drug, put it into the horse intentionally to try to cheat. You know, should he have been more careful? Should he have gotten, yes. Should he have gotten this positive? No. But to me, the things like this, you know, we see these with these trainers all the time, especially the bigger outfits where they're training 100, 150 horses. You know, I think it's just more a matter of sloppiness. So, you know, we're going to have a discussion later about Lasix and showing it. What, you know, if things are more serious than Lasix, I think we're going to talk about. But, you know, this is what I'm saying. This is not Jason Service. This is not Jorge Navarro. You know, so if you want to look at the system and say it's got to change, well, you can't blame the CHRB because, as you said, that's what the rules were. They fined him what was in the rule. So, you know, I don't want to let anybody who may drug a horse off the hook. But I just don't, you know, think these things are that big a deal.
That's a hot take. That's a hot take right there. I thought you'd be on our side. I mean, it's, yes, individually, this drug positive is not a huge deal, but collectively, the drumbeat of trainers getting busted and then getting slaps on the wrist is a huge deal, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to say the guy should have got 10 days or something, I've got no problem with that. But I just think that, you know, we lose focus of what's important here. And, you know, if they use 1,000,001 therapeutic medications on these horses, and you go down the list of trainers, I mean, it's hard to find a guy that hasn't had this happen to them at some point in time in their careers. You know, even the people that we think are, you know, the squeaky clean guys. I mean, Shug McGahee got a drug positive a couple of years ago. Does anybody think Shug McGahee cheats? It's got to be one of the most honest trainers in horse racing. So, you know, blank happens. Do you want to penalize these guys more? Yeah, I got no problem with that. You know, give them a $5,000 fine or give them 10 days or something like that. But, you know, I just, when these things come up, I never really get that excited or get that, you know, like I said, hot and bothered about it.
Yeah, Bill, the only thing I would say about it is if you Google Shug McGahee positives or Shug McGahee fines, it's going to be, maybe there'll be a couple articles, like you said, over the course of his illustrious 40, you know, 50 year career. If you Google Peter Miller drug fines or drug suspensions, there's three pages of articles that pop up. And then there's another couple of pages that pop up because he says, you know, quote unquote, I'm an emotional, volatile guy. He's had 7 disorderly conduct violations in addition to all the medication positives. So I know you can separate the two and say, you know, is he a good guy, good trainer, bad guy, good trainer, you know, or any combination thereof. But he has shown consistently that he has gone against the rules when it comes to medications. And I think that guys like, you know, like them kind of thumb their nose at the rules and say, you know what, if I get caught, which is a very small chance I'm going to get caught, then I'll pay the fine because, you know, it's going to be a fraction of what I'm going to earn. And also it's going to be, you know, kind of glossed over when I get all these other new owners coming in, because I'm winning all these races at a high clip, or I'm winning top races now. So, to me, it's a little different. Yes, a lot of trainers use therapeutic medications. Maybe all of them do. It comes down to, you know, how aggressive they are and whether or not they're just kind of thumbing their nose at the rules because they know that they have the wherewithal to pay it off. So I don't agree with your comment about, you know, all trainers, you know, have positives, therefore it's kind of acceptable. I think it's more on the lines of, you know, this is a broken system because not only is the guy allegedly taking advantage of the system, but then he also, on top of it, we as an industry don't have a penal system hard enough to make these guys not do it anymore. So it's a systemic problem more so than just kind of the cast of characters that are taking advantage of that system.
Yeah, like I said, you can fill in a different trainer's name every time. The result is the same. There's no deterrence for drug positives. Like that's the issue, where regardless of who it is or what drug or how much over the limit it was, the crux of the problem is there's no deterrence. And that's why you need the enforcement that we're going to get, hopefully, in the next year with USADA. Just for context, like, Peter Miller is a guy who does move up horses off the claim. And you have to look no further than this weekend. CZ Rocket, who won the Count Fleet Sprint as a 7-year-old at Oaklawn, he was claimed for $40,000 last year by Peter Miller. And I don't know if it was in his next race or the race after that. He then set a new track record at Keeneland for 6.5 furlongs. Obviously, the track was pretty fast last year in the summer meet at Keeneland, but regardless, this was a horse that other people had given up on. And now he's won like five or six stakes since then. So, you know, it's happening. I think a lot of people think this is happening in front of their eyes and they're powerless to do anything to stop it. And the people who are in power and have a chance to stop it are either unwilling or unable to. And I think that's what leads to the frustration from so many people. And I, like I said, I encourage you to go check out the replies to our tweet of this story, because some of them are pretty damn funny and some of them are very spot on about, you know, what this makes the industry look like, you know, to not just the casual observer, but to the diehard observer. And it's exhausting, honestly, to never see any accountability for guys, you know, unless the FBI comes and gets involved. It's just the way it's going to be until we have this, you know, national drug enforcement policy and program in place. So, you know, we don't like to focus on the bad news on this show. We like to balance it out with a ray of sunshine, or maybe that's just me. I did want to give a shout out to Indiana Grand, which the meet opened yesterday. They're running again today. They announced that they're going to have video stewards explanations after disqualifications and inquiries, which I think is a big deal. And frankly, it's shocking that no one has, you know, suggested this or gone forward with this before this, but, you know, whoever wants to take the lead on something like this that's so crucial to transparency, I tip my hat to you. And Indiana Grand's done a lot of good things recently. They cut takeout on their pick fours. I think that they have HD video now, which again is a thing that should have happened for every track a long time ago, but they have a nice turf course. I think they've done a lot of good things to try to spruce up that meet and make it more enticing and you know, more bettable. And I think that they've done a really good job. And this is just something that's such a no-brainer, I think, for every track to have stewards have this public explanation. And I think a lot of it stems from that Derby 2 years ago when there was just no transparency. It took 22 minutes to disqualify Maximum Security and then released like a 30-second statement and didn't take any questions. I thought, you know, a lot of people rightfully figured that was going to be a terrible look for the industry, and it was. So, you know, shout out to Indiana Grand. And I think, you know, you're still going to get, you know, I think, what you would feel are arbitrary stewards rulings. You're still not going to agree with every disqualification or non-DQ, but at least this time, now you, with this track, you have an explanation, you have something to go off. And I think it's, you know, the NBA has done a little bit of this when they released the last 2-minute report. And what they do is after every game, they go through all the calls in the last 2 minutes of a game and they assess which ones were correct, which ones were wrong, and they release a report to the public and to each team acknowledging where there were mistakes, or if there was a controversial call that they believed was correct, explaining why it was correct. And I think that that's something that racing could sorely, sorely use, and Indiana Grand is taking that step out to do something like that. And I hope a lot of other tracks follow suit, because there's literally no downside to doing this. Unless you have some stewards who are extremely camera shy, I don't see any possible downside to taking this initiative and running with it and making that the standard, I think, for American racing. I think that should be something that happens in the next year or two. And if and when it does, we're going to have Indiana Grand, I think, to thank, at least in part, because they're willing to step out there and do that first. So hat tip to them and keep up the good work over at Indiana Grand. I'll keep plugging you guys and hope that people catch on and start betting it, because I think, you know, of the smaller tracks, it's one of the better products out there, and it keeps showing why. Joining the West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
So exciting news this week. We have a new sponsor. This is our fourth sponsor with potentially more to come. We always appreciate everyone in this industry who supports our show. It is the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Now, if you remember a couple weeks ago, we had Andrew Offerman on from Canterbury Park. It was a very well-received episode. It was great to talk to him and give a little shine to one of the smaller tracks that's doing the right things. And now we have a sponsorship that came out of it. And we definitely want to shout out everybody who's racing in Minnesota. It's a great program. So thanks to the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project for coming along. And they're going to sponsor every week the most read TDN story of the week. So the most read TDN story of the week is brought to you by the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Racehorse ownership opportunities for Canterbury Park's upcoming meet are now available. Visit racehorseminnesota.com and get in the game for as little as $250. So this week's most read story comes from Joe Orsino, who is a longtime trainer. He's worked with John a little bit over the years, and he had Imprimis, who was second in the Shakertown last weekend at Keeneland, and he came back with blood coming out of his nostrils. So Joe Orsino gave some post-race comments that kind of lit up the decision to, you know, ban Lasix and stakes races and, you know, slowly ban Lasix over time in the sport. Now, it turns out it wasn't pulmonary hemorrhage. I think Orsino said that he banged his nose or something in the gate. So it was good that he didn't bleed in that way, but he stood by his comments and basically was saying, listen, I've had a horse who's been running on Lasix his whole life, who is a bleeder. And now they're telling me that he's ineligible to run with Lasix. And, you know, it's detrimental to the horse. It's detrimental to the connections behind the horse. And I think he makes a good point. And I think that there's been a little bit of a one size fits all approach to Lasix in this industry. And I think that there should be exceptions for horses like Imprimis, who are documented bleeders and have been running on Lasix for so long. I think it's borderline cruel to then take that away from the horse. I mean, he's not the only one. I'm sure there's a bunch of older horses who are currently running in stakes, you know, who are not allowed to race on Lasix. But John and Bill, I think, have stronger opinions on this than me. So I'll toss it over to them, starting with Bill.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of opinions on this, but I'll start with this. Imprimis is the poster child for banning Lasix, because look what has happened to this horse since they took away Lasix in the stakes races. He wins the Tamina Stakes at Gulfstream Park, then goes to Tampa Bay Downs and runs second with Lasix on the turf dash, then comes back to Keeneland and runs second, a beautiful race, second by a nose in the Shakertown, bound for nowhere. Buyer numbers are within a few points from every single race. He also ran in England and Royal Ascot without Lasix. He's proving what seems to be the case out there, that these horses don't really need this stuff. And it's funny because, you know, I'm glad Joe Orsino, you know, owned up to the mistake he made, but there was this great, you know, controversy when a horse didn't even bleed. So, you know, I know, like, you know, people get passionate about this, But I did see, Joe, it's cruel to take it away. Come on, that's ridiculous. I mean, they ran horse racing for 400 years in this country without LASIKs, and they run it everywhere else in the world without LASIKs, and they do just fine. You know, I do buy the argument that there's more serious problems. I've got no problem with that. But I mean, it's ironic that this horse is out there writing a story every time he runs that LASIKs, no big deal.
I'm going to take a different approach to this. And Bill, I understand what you're saying as far as the horse is running well with or without LASIKs. Therefore, you know, what are we really talking about here? Because, you know, it almost doesn't matter in essence, according to the way the horse is running and according to his numbers. But I can tell you from talking to trainers, not just Joe, but other trainers that are in the industry who are up against this LASIKs ban with older horses that have, you know, run their career on this medication. And basically, it's not that they're taking LASIKs away and the horses magically aren't bleeding. Basically, what the trainers have to do is figure out other ways outside of LASIKs to try to take care of the issue. Now, you can make the argument that horses that are bleeding internally, should they really be racing? Okay, that's I think an argument that we all would, you know, stand behind, which is, you know, why are these horses bleeding? Why are they putting themselves to such a test that it's forcing them to have their capillaries burst and therefore, you know, bleed to their lungs and out their nose? Should we be doing that as an industry, or should we be doing that really as human beings? That's a whole nother question. I mean, because, you know, we really shouldn't be pushing these animals, these athletes, to that extent. But that being said, you know, a lot of the old time trainers who used to run in New York and didn't have the benefit of LASIKs, basically what they would do is they would, if they couldn't, you know, chemically reduce the horse's, you know, blood flow, then they would basically take all the water away and take the horse's food away for 12 or 18 hours before the horse would run and dehydrate the horse and then expect the horse to run and hopefully not bleed. So, you know, the advent of LASIKs and Salix and other generic medications to help horses from not bleeding were basically to replace the practice of dehydrating horses before they would run. And LASIKs allows them to be fully hydrated, especially, you know, which is needed in the hotter climates and in the warmer conditions. And basically to avoid having horses starved and dehydrated to the point where, you know, they that's the only way they can get them to run without bleeding. So, you know, the medication has a purpose. I think that as an industry, we have to look at two things. One is, you know, why are we running horses to this extent where they need to have some kind of a practice or some kind of a medication to keep them from bleeding? And the other is LASIKs really the issue in the industry when we have all these other illegal medications that people are using and basically enhancing horses' performances? You know, LASIKs is not a performance enhancing drug. It's basically allowing a horse to run at the level that it should be able to run without having to have internal bleeding. So, you know, I think as an industry, those are the two big issues that we really need to address. And I understand, Bill, what you're saying is, hey, the horse is running well, irrespective of LASIKs. And I think that's a credit to Joe's horsemanship that he can do it. But eventually, you know, when you have a 7-year-old that's run a bunch of races on LASIKs, and then you're saying as an industry, we're taking away this medication, now try to find something else that'll help the horse, and we still expect the horse to run well. I think that's unfair to some of these horses and some of these horsemen in general.
Yeah, I mean, agreed. I never thought of it as a performance enhancing drug. I thought of it as a performance enabling drug, where horses, you know, had this ability, but they couldn't show it because they were bleeders. And I think a lot of this stems from the fact that I think this has been a red herring, like Bill has said, that, you know, racing has gotten tough on LASIKs to kind of look like it's doing something about the drug problem as a whole. And it really hasn't done anything about the drug problem as a whole. But if you target this one drug that everybody uses and you disrupt the industry in that way, then it looks like you're taking, you know, you're the bad cop and you're taking, you know, the cheaters out, but it's not what you're doing. I think there should be exceptions. You know, if you want to ban LASIKs over time, I'm not going to scream and cry about it. But I think that there should be exceptions for horses who are documented bleeders, especially horses like Imprimis, who have been running their whole life. This is, I think, his fifth year racing. And he's run his other 4 years on Lasix. And, you know, whether or not he bled in this race, I still think it's a bit of a clumsy approach to just ban it completely, regardless of the individual horse's circumstances. And like I said, I think it comes from, you know, a little bit of a distraction from the fact that racing doesn't do anything about its drug problem overall, that it's found this one thing that it can focus on and look like it's being tough on crime. You know, we talked about this before, and I've said I haven't really seen a definitive study either way that horses definitely need Lasix, horses definitely don't need Lasix. I think it varies depending on the horse. So I wonder if there are going to be more cases like this, and a little bit more pushback on the blanket ban of Lasix in stakes races.
Yeah, and Joe, let me just say one more thing. The reason why I think Joe was so upset about it is, you know, he cares so much for his horses, and he's not the only trainer that feels that way. As far as, you know, being around the horses every day and training them and feeling like really that they're just a part of his family versus, you know, an asset that is going to make money for them. You know, Joe and a lot of hardworking trainers are out there every morning, you know, taking care of their stock and taking care of their stables. And, you know, Joe is the kind of guy who will, you know, say what's on his mind. So when they interviewed him after the race and it looked like the horse had actually bled, you know, because of the race, it genuinely pained him. And you can hear it in his voice about how he was basically pleading to the industry, saying, you're basically forcing me to hurt my horse in order to get him to run if we can't run with Lasix. And that's unfair. It's unfair to the horse. It's unfair to the owners. It's unfair to the trainers that are involved. So if there was some kind of grandfathered opportunity or option, like with the 140 mare rule, you know, where it is a grandfathered, you know, status in essence with horses that are standing at stud now, and basically start to slowly work its way out of the industry, then I think a lot of the trainers would feel better, because horses like Impermis, who have run a dozen and a half times, you know, in their careers over a course of 4 or 5 years, where they would at least, you know, wouldn't get them on the Lasix to begin with, and therefore have to like wean them off of it or have other alternatives for it as well. But I think that's why Joe was so impassioned with his plea, because he does care about his horses and he does genuinely want to do the right thing for the horse.
Yep. And, you know, you can talk about how they don't use Lasix all over the world and they didn't use Lasix in the 18th century. The fact is they've been using it in America for decades now, and it's going to take time if that's what you want to do to wean that out of the racing population. And I just think doing it suddenly like that is a recipe for problems like this, especially for older horses. And it's, I don't know. It's like I said, I think it's a little bit of a distraction from the fact that we haven't done anything. And, you know, just to see these two headlines next to each other, Peter Miller gets a $500 fine for an actual performance enhancing drug, and Joe Orsino is upset that, you know, his horse might have bled because of these blanket rules that ban Lasix from, you know, the racehorses. It's a little bit of a contradiction, and I think that was laid bare by those two stories.
No, exactly. And just to go full circle from the intro, the reason why, you know, I've known Joe for 35 years, and Joe and I were actually in Kentucky at the Keeneland 2-year-old sale, our sponsor, at the Keeneland 2-year-old sale, you know, 24 years ago, because my wife wasn't due until mid-May. So we figured I can get down to Kentucky. And sure enough, we got the call, you know, 2 a.m. that Michelle was going into labor. Joe drove me to the airport. Basically, I was in shock because it was my first kid. Like, basically, got me through security, got me onto the plane, and then I flew home, and the baby was born. But I just know he's a good guy. I mean, he wants to do the right thing for everybody and you know, for his horses. And I'm glad he's getting some positive notoriety for taking a stand on something like this.
For sure. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is Hall of Fame trainer Steve Asmussen. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on.
So we're glad to have you, obviously, coming off the huge win in the Arkansas Derby. Congratulations on that, first of all, with Superstock. He's an interesting horse because he's a family horse for you. In case anybody doesn't know, he's co-owned by your father. He also was the first stakes winner for your oldest son as a jockey last year at Lone Star. So I just kind of wanted to ask about how, if at all, it feels different to train a horse who has that much sentimentality to you and your family?
Very different, and exploring it all the time. You know, it's just very different feelings. We've been very fortunate in horse racing, had many successes. But as you mentioned, you know, a circumstance in which you can leg your son up on a stakes winner for your parents is quite unique, to say the least. And that a very special experience. And then for that same horse to come along and win the Grade One Arkansas Derby and be in the position that we feel that we're in 17 days before the Kentucky Derby is special, to say the least. Just so many emotions about it. You imagine having that kind of success going into the race, but I did not realize what actually it meant. And the outpouring of love and respect and support for my parents and who they are since the race has probably been the best part for me.
Steve, thanks for joining us. I want to stay on the same subject. And your father's sort of the unsung hero of the Asmussen clan. You and Cash have gotten so much positive press over the years. You're in the Hall of Fame. But your dad was the guy who started everything. He's working hard. What is it, do you think it means to him and your mother as well to have this horse in the Kentucky Derby after, you know, the great career he's had in racing?
Well, a lot of, you know, the ideas like going through my head and the discussions that me and Julie, my wife, and the boys have had is this. You're exactly accurate on that. This is my mom and dad's story, and they've supported us unwavering and put me and Cash in the positions that we've been in to have success in this business. And then at their they're both 79 years old, and to come along and unique circumstances allowed them to keep this horse. You know, Dad's had Grade One winners in the past. He's just sold them all. And that probably would have happened with this horse as well, if not for the pandemic. And then Keith coming along riding and asking to ride the horse and those sort of things. It's just so many circumstances that have brought mom and dad to the forefront and getting the respect and admiration that I know they deserve.
Yeah. And we heard on one of the other interviews that Steve, you know, this horse was actually entered into the sale, which is why he was eligible for that first stake race at Lone Star. So it's amazing the way things come together. And I guess this horse was meant to be for you guys to enjoy the ride in the Kentucky Derby. And you have another horse that probably is going to run in the Derby also, in Midnight Bourbon, who all he's done is run seven times and hit the board all seven. And, you know, is coming out of what we feel like are some of the toughest 3-year-old preps that have been run this year. Tell us a little bit about your other part of the entry, Midnight Bourbon.
Oh, absolutely. I think you stated it extremely well. Midnight Bourbon's he checks a lot of the boxes. You know, solid 2-year-old form, maintained very good company. He has incrementally gotten faster with the races getting incrementally longer. Just so many positives about him. And then he being in Churchill right now, he is a picture of health, goes over the racetrack very well, and is training superbly. He's an outstanding opportunity going into the Derby. And we're talking family now, and Ron Winchell and his family and the Asmussens have been associated a long time. So we are looking at some very special feelings going into this year's Derby with both of the horses we get to run.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off that, because obviously you've had a legendary career. You're in the Hall of Fame. You won a ton of big races. Have not won the Derby yet from 21 starters. I want to know just honestly from you how you think it might change your life or your outlook or anything if you were to win the Derby. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it would. I'm curious if you could predict the future and you won the Derby. How much of a different person do you think you would be?
I don't know. You know, we gotta. You said the word honestly. You know, honestly, I'd hate to lose this chip on my shoulder. You know, don't lose the edge. Next horse that you run is the most important horse. And I, you know, everything, you know, our motto around here is everything matters or nothing matters. So don't lose that chip. You know, we got to keep it in front of us. We get tremendous opportunities and we respect them and want to make the most of them. the win for with Superstock, the circumstances, it was meant to be. A lot of times you walk over there and you run a horse and he doesn't win. He runs a good enough race. It just wasn't meant to be, is simply the answer. Whenever Superstock won, it was meant to be, you know. So I think that that's what we're looking for going into the Derby. It'll happen if it's meant to be. We have two horses that have a tremendous amount of talent that are doing extremely well. That to have success in the Derby, they're going to need to get the trip and run the race of their life. And it will happen if it's meant to be.
Steve, one of the things that's always fascinated me about your career is, you know, year in and year out, you have superstars in the barn. Curlin, Rachel Alexandra just won the Arkansas Derby, Matoli, et cetera. Yet at the same time, you'll claim a horse for $7,500 at Sam Houston. And, you know, you don't see many top trainers doing that. Todd Fletcher doesn't do that. Bob Baffert doesn't do that. My guess is that you just have an insatiable thirst for victory. But tell us why you still, you know, play that game as well.
Because I love those horses. It's unique into itself. Every race is unique into itself. I do it because they run those races, because they have those horses, and it is that opportunity, and I love it. It's my passion and my hobby and everything in between.
Steve, I want to play a quick speed round game with you, just called Who's Better, because you've trained some phenomenal horses, have won the Belmont. And you got to play Who's Better, all right?
I think we're having trouble with my connection right now.
Come on, the world wants to know. We'll give you a couple of easy ones, all right? Untappable or Summerlee? Both of them won the Kentucky Oaks. Who was better?
Untappable, more talent, and Summerlee, the professionalism to get you there first. And that is a unique quality in a horse.
Yep. Midnight Bisou or Rachel Alexandra?
The brilliance of Rachel Alexandra is unmatched. She was like Pegasus. You cannot compare her to another horse. And the pure elegance of Midnight Bisou, just the presence of her and how strong she was with her personality that never wavered with, you know, whether it was the boys in Saudi Arabia or whatever, she has a presence before, during, and after racing that is unmatched.
Okay. Great answer. Curlin or Gun Runner?
Curlin is separate from everything because he could do things we couldn't do. I do think that he got us to this stage. First classic winner for us. He taught us how to be on this stage. He carried us. He most alpha mammal that I've ever been around in my life. Other horses did not act themselves, from the lead pony or any other horse in the barn or anybody he ever ran against, the same in his presence. The most alpha of any creature I've ever been around. And Gunrunner, I feel like we had more to do with his career. And what a brilliant career it was. And the proudest of Gunrunner is he was the fastest when he was at the end. Great to begin, incremental improvement. I love his line. It's a portrait. Gunrunner's career is a portrait, and what I'm aiming at with all of them.
Yep. And since you mentioned Gunrunner, now that the Gunrunners are 2 year, his foals are 2 years old from his first crop, what are you seeing at the sales? Because it looks like that everyone is kind of very enamored with them, and they're paying all kinds of money for them.
Oh, it's extremely exciting. You know, Gunrunner came out of the OBS March 2-year-old in training sale off the Niall Brennan consignment without going through the ring. Dr. Lambert, Ron Winchell at Dr. Lambert's suggestion, partnered with Mr. Tori Alba and Three Chimneys, who owned him going into the sale. But he was there, went through the work show, but was purchased before he went through the ring. So he also showed something at that stage, but continued to get better. So it's nothing but exciting how good they are now, with all the common sense in the world saying the older they are and the further you go, the more success you're going to have.
Right. I totally agree with all of your picks, by the way. You were very cagey about it, but I think I had the right ones when John speed round. All right, last question from me. We talked about this right before you came on. Joe Orsino had some comments last week after the Shaker Town. It looked like his horse Imprimis had bled. Turns out he didn't, but he had some comments about how the Lasix ban isn't fair, especially for older horses who have been running on it their whole life. I'm wondering if you have any opinions or ideas about how to better treat the horses through this Lasix ban.
It's an extremely touchy subject, and it's just another rule that's very hard on the small guy. The more rules they make, the bigger advantage to the bigger stables like mine. And I love where I came from in the humble beginnings. If you have a couple good horses, you're very fortunate at that stage. And to imagine one of them being eliminated for a reason like that would be, very personal. It's just the more rules they put in, the more important it is to have numbers and to be big.
Steve, sometime probably late summer, maybe early fall, you will win your 9,446th race. And when you do that, you will be the winningest trainer in the history of thoroughbred racing. I mean, what a tremendous accomplishment that is going to be for your career. Dale Baird, who was at Waterford Park for many, many years, is still ahead of you. But could you just reflect on that, Steve, and how far you've come to, not just, win big races and have good horses, but again, something historic, the winningest trainer in the history of the sport. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's extremely significant to me because anybody who's been in it knows how hard one race is to win, and the money will always change and be impossible to measure one time against the other, but wins will not. They will be just as hard to win every single time you try to do it. And I do believe that it makes it extremely significant, even though at 9,446th, I will be second all time, but it will be in front in North America. There, Juan Suarez Villarreal in Peru has won, went by Baird a couple of years ago. I don't know what an accurate number of what he has out there, but it is, I very much look forward to number 9,446. I think your assessment, at the beginning of the year, I targeted Labor Day, wanted to, as potentially being the time when we could get to that point. And we're off to a very good start, so maybe we can shorten that by weeks, possibly. But it's just like your question about the Derby. How will you feel afterwards? Yes, it is a major goal, major accomplishment. Plan on getting it done. Plan on getting to 9,446. But it seems somehow there's always something else out there to do, to accomplish.
All right, Steve, we really appreciate the time. Good luck in the Derby, and good luck keeping that chip on your shoulder as well.
Thank you. I do a good job at it. All right.
Talk to you, Steve. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Steve Asmussen, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust the Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit the Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so we don't have quite the blockbuster racing that we've had the last 2 weeks, but we do have one big main event on Saturday at Oaklawn. It's the $1 million Apple Blossom Handicap, and it's the much-anticipated rematch between Monomoy Girl and Swiss Skydiver. Now, we really didn't get that in the Breeders' Cup distaff because Swiss Skydiver was off pretty badly, didn't have a great trip. Monomoy Girl had that usual trip that she gets where she just puts herself out in the clear and ends up winning. So hopefully both horses will get a clean trip this time. Swiss Skydiver drew the 2-hole. Monomoy Girl drew the 6-hole. So that'll be like the distaff where Swiss Skydiver was drawn inside of Monomoy Girl. It's a 6-horse field. Latruska, who's drawn one stall outside of Swiss Skydiver makes things a little bit interesting because she's a one-way speed ball, and she's one of those kind of horses who, you know, kind of acts as a rabbit a little bit and can take other horses out of their game trying to go chase her because she's super, super fast. So that's one, that's an interesting little wrinkle in the race. So those three are the main contenders, but obviously all eyes are going to be on Swiss Skydiver and Modern White Girl, and we're ready for that matchup. We'll all be watching on Saturday evening. Also, the $1 million Oaklawn handicap, which is a grade two, is Saturday as well at Oaklawn. There's an 8-horse field, no superstars, but a couple of interesting horses. Silver State, we probably should have asked Steve Asmussen about, but didn't. He's an up-and-coming horse. Warriors Charges in there, Fearless for Todd Pletcher, Express Train, who was second in the Santa Anita handicap. So two pretty interesting big $1 million races at Oaklawn this weekend. Well, I'm sure we'll have lots of reaction from the Swiss Skydiver Bottom Ring World matchup next week. So the big announcement that I teased at the beginning of the show, John and I will be heading down to Ocala next week to do our first on-scene TDN Writers Room. We're looking forward to that. We're going to meet up with Patty and the crew, and we're going to Wednesday we're going to record. We're going to do some interviews as well beforehand, and it's going to be great. I've never been to a sale, so this is going to be an experience for me. Nor have I been on a private plane. So this is like the fresh air fun when you used to take kids from like the inner city and like send them out to the country so they can run around a field. That's what this is going to be like for me. So I'm excited about that. John, any thoughts?
Just that, Joe, I got your catering request and they can't take the orange M&Ms out of the bag. So you're going to have to deal with that. But otherwise, everything else is great. We're really looking forward to doing an on location show. And we're going to miss Bill because, I know Bill's unable to come down. But you will be there in spirit, Mr. Finley.
I will be thinking of you guys.
Definitely. We'll talk about the Red Sox. So it's like you're there. And I'm glad you got my rider, John, but it's unfortunate that they're unable to accommodate me. I guess I'll still go.
You still go. That's awful kind of you. But no, we're really looking forward to not only being at the sale with all the action that goes on at the sale, but it's going to kind of be Millionaire's Row with a couple of the people we're interviewing and big buyers and big sellers and some of the top consigners that are in the industry. And hopefully we'll continue on with some rapid fire questions for them. But it's going to be full action and an exciting venue for us next week.
Yeah, so look forward to that. We'll see you live from Ocala. Well, not live, but we'll be in Ocala. We'll be live in Ocala.
We'll be alive in Ocala.
You understand what I'm saying, right? Yeah. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. I remind you that the Keeneland Spring Meet is back. More racing action resumes later today. The meet will run through April 23rd. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Steve Asmussen, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Danny Cyper, who just had a baby. Congrats to Danny Cyper. All right, so we will see you next week from Ocala. Rest in peace, DMX. Talk to you next week.